Thanks.
I ought to start with sort of two admissions, really. I'm sort of broadly a market economics person. I'm also a transport operator. Not a happy position at the moment. National Express, well known for our coaches, we are mainly, in fact, a railway operator. We are probably the largest private railway operator in the world. I want to speak mainly this evening about buses, which I think are under-discussed in this context. So why the humble bus is important, and I concentrate on the bus because this was quite a unique opportunity to talk to a middle-class audience about what is not normally high on their agenda. Some of this data you've seen already this evening, the public transport mode share, the domination of bus in terms of journeys, and you'll see that of the balance, London Underground is incredibly important. In fact, incredibly, London Underground carries as many passengers as the National Railway Network. Trams and so forth, despite the growth we've heard, are really quite irrelevant in terms of overall mode share. So about 4.9 billion journeys were made, about 1.9 billion journeys by the rail modes. And we're about 3 out of every 4 public transport journey. But if you look at how far people travel, it's a rather different picture. Rail is obviously a much longer distance mode, dominates the public transport market for longer journeys, and coach starts to come in as well. So in terms of public transport, if we want to do anything about integrating transport, we really have got to do something about the bus. And I think that's one of the great insights of John Prescott's transport policy. What are the attributes of the bus? I said I was a bit of a market economics person. I think it's actually a good thing that the bus network can be operated largely commercially. Great bulk of bus costs are recovered from passenger fares. The tendered bus network is quite small. And I think that's a good thing for a number of reasons. First of all, I think it creates the right sort of incentives. It creates incentives for us to carry passengers. It also reflects the fact that the government is inevitably short of money. There are other priorities for health, education, social services, and transport will struggle to compete with those. It's quite cheap for users. Bus fares, average bus fares, around about 50 pence, much lower than the other modes. And it's socially inclusive. Buses tend to be used, in fact depended on, by low-income groups, particularly the elderly, the young. People on low incomes generally tend to be heavy bus users. So there are good social reasons as well as congestion-related reasons to be worried about buses. The other thing about buses, and I think perhaps their unique quality, is the comprehensiveness of the network. Now, I've got some statistics there from the government about how close people are to bus routes, but I think a much easier way of understanding this is to think about the West Midlands, where I used to run the buses, and I had the dubious distinction of building the tramway network, which is a somewhat traumatic experience, not quite as bad as Sheffield, but certainly added a few grey hairs. In the West Midlands, there are about 22 tram stops, about 70 railway stations, and about 16,000 bus stops. So that gives you some idea about the network density. It's really impossible to provide that sort of network density with the rail modes. And that's equally true in the UK if you look at the rural network as well. We actually have a remarkably comprehensive rural interurban bus network by in comparison with other countries, particularly places like France. Compared to rail-based urban public transport, I'm not in any way suggesting there's no role for this, but compared to rail-based urban public transport, the land take is minimal, the capital costs of buses are very low, even quite a fancy bus, a bendy bus with all sorts of fancy things, air conditioning and so on, will be relatively inexpensive compared to an equivalent tram. And I think another important point is that we can concentrate the track in the hot spots. If you have a rail-based system, you need an inch of track for every inch of route. With a public transport system, you can build the track where you actually need it, which may not be everywhere. The permissions process is simple, and picking up on what Bill was saying about the issues relating to safety, we have an equally absurd over-regulation of permissions. I mean, the process of actually building a tramway system or a railway system is quite ridiculously involved, despite some efforts at deregulation over the last few years. So the humble bus is the dominant mode of public transport. It has extensive rural coverage, and it has some characteristics, modal characteristics, which I think make it very important over the next few years. However, it is not typically used by the chattering classes, which we probably all secretly form a part of in this room. There are some exceptions. The bus company that Bill's involved with in Edinburgh, there's certainly some chattering passengers on there, and there are some parts of London, Exeter and Oxford, where the people who run the country travel on buses. But typically they don't. and typically they've been less interested in them. So I think buses are important. They're good news for people in Jaguars because quick wins are possible. Now, I'm generally optimistic about the bus industry, but there are some current issues that I think are worth dwelling on. I'm going to run through each of these in some sort of order. The big problem is the one that Bill has so adequately described. Rising car ownership has a quite different effect on buses than on the other modes. Principally, it leads to urban dispersal. I think that's the biggest problem. It's very difficult to address that. The sort of situation you face in Los Angeles, where actually trying to provide an adequate network is almost impossible. It's encouraged depopulation in big urban areas. Habits have changed on the back of rising car ownership, typically the switch towards television. And there's been a historical lack of incentives amongst the operators who were conditioned into kind of strange mode where if things went wrong, you simply went to the local authority and asked for some more money, and we didn't really matter whether we carried any passengers or not. That was really very unhealthy. And that led to the kind of situation we see here. Traffic congestion has risen. Bus journeys have become slower. They've become unreliable, and bus passengers, most of all, are interested in reliability above all else. Costs have risen, fares have risen, and that's encouraged the more use of cars. Now, something rather different has been happening in rail over the last few years. Again, I think we've touched on this evening. Quite different effect seems to have happened. Now, there's a key statistic on rail at the moment. We're back up to pre-Hatfield, about 1946 levels of patronage. Really quite extraordinary growth in rail patronage. I mean, the world was quite a different place in 1946. And that's partly because services have improved. There are more trains running to more destinations and fares are falling in real terms. But there are some other things happening as well. And it's principally because traffic congestion has made the relative speed of rail better in relation to car for a whole range of journeys. And we're seeing something quite profoundly different going on in the rail market. And I think one of the key issues post-Hatfield is whether or not we can recover quickly those huge gains in patronage which have occurred, which have such important social benefits. So I think we need to make buses more like trains. What I mean by that is that we need to give them a dedicated track. Now, that really means reallocating road space, and that is both a carrot and a stick. The sorts of policies that we're talking about here, not just bus lanes, but also bus gates, short sections of road only open to buses, bus-activated traffic signals, queue relocation, that's actually moving the queue of traffic somewhere where actually you can accommodate it, where the road is wide enough, moving the queue, GPS location systems, but most importantly, enforcing all of those things so that the system actually becomes faster and more reliable for passengers, which is the way that we'll get them. But efficiency may require bravery. We operate a lot of coaches down the M4 bus lane. Bill has described the Oxford Balanced Transport Policy. These policies can be justified on very objective grounds, but there's a strong media backlash towards them. And I think the government needs to provide a lead to local politicians and help them out. I mean, the problems that Oxford have had with Top Gear are worth an hour's description in themselves. Quality partnerships on the bus side are terribly important. And what we mean by quality partnerships is essentially a coordinated effort between the public and the private sectors, the operators, the local authorities, the police, to bring together the key things that passengers want in a package. And it's generally been our experience that you get much better results by combining these things than doing any combination of them individually. Just from the West Midlands situation, these are some of the kind of partners that we would be talking about. A whole range of operators, about 30 operators, seven or eight local authorities, the passenger transport executive, the police, and so on. The operators, I think, have to accept a large share of the blame for the history of misery that we've had over the last 40 or 50 years on buses. We've really not, I think, generally grasped the opportunity that was opened up by privatisation to become, take on a real market focus, move away from the utility mode, and go to a more market type of operation. We need far more imaginative pricing and ticketing. Now, I have to admit, I'm one of the people responsible for the 25 different tickets between Sheffield and London, and we've done that for very good reasons. We've done that to widen the market for rail travel and break out of the narrow problems that we had. That some of that technology, that pricing approach, would be very well applied to bus services. We also need to, I think, reconsider in a more segmented way the way that we actually plan the network. We've got to move away from the all things to all people problem that's been a large part of bus route planning. And we need to invest more, not just in vehicles, but in our staff and in the infrastructure. Now, we have actually achieved some dramatic results. These are some examples from the West Midlands. Typical increases in patronage at 20 and 30%. And quite a lot of that's coming from mode shift from car, comparable to sort of light rail figures. So I think generally, I'm optimistic about buses. We're expecting substantial sums from the DETR through the 10-year plan, the transport settlement, Transport for London making very encouraging and sensible noises in this direction. But I think the government does need to deal with enforcement and change the way that local authorities can deal with that. And the operators have got to deal with the image problem that the bus still suffers from. Now, there are some problems as well. On the overall cost point of view, the sort of the Today programme debate, the fact is that motoring costs have fallen in real terms, and the cost of bus and rail fares has risen. And that's been made worse by some problems on fuel taxation for buses. Aircraft and rail pay no fuel tax. Local bus services traditionally had their fuel tax rebated. We currently get partial fuel duty rebate. And that sum of money, that rebate, broadly equates to industry profit. So it's a very key statistic. It was frozen by the Tories from about 92 to 97. And the effect of that has been, to reuse one of their own cliches, a triple whammy on bus fuel costs. The decline in fuel duty rebate, combined with the worsening fuel consumption from making the bus engines more environmentally acceptable, and the rise in fuel costs, have substantially increased the net cost of bus fuel, with obvious pressures on our costs and our fares. The autumn statement last week reduced the cost of motoring, but did not address fuel duty rebate issues. I think that was very disappointing. It wasn't very joined up. Most of our costs are labour costs. Those costs were traditionally inflated. We typically employed too many staff and we paid them a more than a market rate of pay. That was an effect that disappeared fairly rapidly after privatisation. We now operate in competitive labour markets with all other employers. And the cost of labour is rising. Congestion reduces the productivity of our staff. It makes them unhappy. It causes them to leave. There is severe competition for service sector employees. We need more staff for expansion. And there is a general unpopularity, traditional unpopularity of shift working. Transport taxation policy has been confusing. They've just reduced the cost of motoring. Bus fuel costs, as I said, are a problem. And there's still some discontinuity in the way that various perks are taxed. There are still residual tax perks for company cars, but if an employer gives a member of staff a season ticket, that is a taxable perk. So some conclusions. I think John Prescott was absolutely right to target bus growth, and this is true in London as well, as a major object of transport policy. Rail improvements tend to be much more expensive but much more popular, and that's partly because the kind of people who benefit from rail improvements are people who have a lot more political and social clout in the economy as a whole. Bus improvements are very cost-effective, but they are seen as boring, and they do involve upsetting people like Terry Wogan and other influential types who use the M4 and similar bits of infrastructure. But buses could make a big difference quickly. That requires partnership between a number of players, and I think it requires the government to remove some confusion which they've introduced into the debate, really only in the last few months, but which I think is potentially damaging, and I'm expecting good things from the budget. So what I think we're trying to achieve is a virtuous circle based on the reallocation of road space, making the services more reliable, more attractive, increasing the choice available to car users and the increasing number of people who have a choice, attracting more riders and more investment. So on that slightly more optimistic note, I'll end. Thank you.